What are you doing here? What do you hope to gain by coming to Sesshin? This really isn't a trick question. Every one of us could come up with an answer. Everyone knows what's important to them. We all know how to exaggerate things. We have a sense of self that will judge some things as really important and other things as just not worthy. We exaggerate and call some experiences wonderful and others awful. And so this kind of exaggeration mind becomes like a superglue for the self, continually binding these little life moments together, creating a story over which we can rejoice or despair. We're actually taught to put together this narrative of a life at a very early age. I remember when I was working in elementary school, and kids would arrive in school in September, and they always were asked, how did you spend your summer vacation? Probably you had to write about that. And it was all pretty predictable. They'd say, you know, well, they tell stories about going to summer camp, swimming, visiting grandparents, taking trips. Most of them, but some were kind of unique and surprising. I remember the boy who said, I went to Six Flags this summer. He said, first we took Route 3. Then we got off on Exit 6. And then we went to Route 84. And then we went to Route 91. And then we took Exit 46. I had fun. Then I went home and took Exit 91 and on it went. Or there was a girl at the end of a snow day. She came in, they were to tell the story of what they did with their snow day. And she said, I took out my sled. There's no stove on a sled. There are no plates on a sled. And she described all the things that you would never see on a sled. Of course, there's nothing wrong with learning how to weave a coherent story of a life. Nothing wrong with noticing what's important and interesting. Nothing wrong with creating a narrative that helps us function as unique human beings in the world. Part of my job was to help some of these kids sort of expand what they attended to in the world. Because where your attention goes, so goes your life. So what we exaggerate as important and worthy creates a self we identify with. And what we present to the world. In Sesshin, however, this is not the mind. This isn't the attention we're encouraged to cultivate. This is not the realm of the eight worldly winds of gain and loss and praise and blame and fame and disrepute and pleasure and pain. Sesshin is not the time for preference and judgment and exaggeration. In Sesshin, we have the opportunity to relate to the world in an entirely different way. Sesshin is the place where we can learn to stop exaggerating, where we can learn to stop making some experiences really important and meaningful, and stop making other experiences unworthy of our attention. So today's koan is a wonderful illustration of the fruits of this kind of attention learned through Zazen and learned in Sesshin. It's case number 17 in the Mumon Kan. The national teacher calls three times. Here's the main case. The national teacher called his attendant three times, and three times he answered. The national teacher said, "I thought I had transgressed against you, but you have transgressed against me." The commentary. The national teacher called three times, and his tongue dropped to the ground. The attendant answered three times, sending out a corresponding glory. The national teacher, getting old and lonely, pushed the cow's head down to the grass. The attendant would have none of it. Even delicious food cannot attract a full stomach. Now tell me, in what did the transgressing consist? When the country is prosperous, the witty man is lionized. When the house is wealthy, the child is spoiled. And the verse. He must carry the holeless iron kang, and his descendants too can have no peace or rest. If you want to support the gate and sustain the house, you must climb a mountain of swords with bare feet. So, let's begin by looking at the two main characters here. The teacher here is Echu, and he's what they called the Kokuchi. That is the teacher of the emperor. And it's said that he was so revered by this emperor that the emperor would personally push him around in his cart. So Echu, as national teacher, had thousands of students. And it is said that everyone tried to go to him at least once in a lifetime. So the other character here is Ocean. And in koan, most frequently, monks sort of miss what's being taught. But in this koan, this monk, Ocean, does not miss it. And of all the students Echu had, Ocean was his attendant and his sole Dharma heir. So when I read this koan, two memories came up for me. The first one was a memory of Richard saying that the best movie he ever saw about Zen was the movie Remains of the Day. You've all probably seen it. It was about this like perfect servant who did his duty with absolute, meticulous attention to detail. And near the end, when he found out that when his employer had done some not good things, he was asked by someone what he thought about what was going on as he was serving him. And this is what he said: "A man cannot be contented until he has done everything he can for his employer. I was there to serve him, not to agree or disagree." And this man, this servant, so embraced his karma that he never allowed his emotions to exaggerate or to create wishes for things to be otherwise. It was a remarkable film. So there's some little of this quality that of Ocean that reminded me of this particular movie. The other memory that arose for me was of a time now many years ago when Elizabeth and I would do sesshin planning. And it would take days. Who was going to transport what? Who was going to get letters with recipes for making and freezing sauces? Who was going to be assigned what jobs? And sometimes there were 30 students, so there wasn't enough room in the monastery. We had to find room down in the main building with new instructions. And it all got very complicated. I have like a 6-inch book that gives every detail of what had to be done back then and the forms that had to be sent out. And I was thinking about what would that have been like for me if, because you had to like stay really concentrated because there were so many pieces to put together. And what if in another room, as I was doing this with Elizabeth, Richard called out, "Norma." I go like, "Yeah?" I go, "Oh, yes." "Oh, never mind." And I just imagine myself and going back again and just getting my head around this and hearing him say, "Norma," and be like, "What? Go in." "Yeah?" "Oh, never mind." And then again, "Norma." "Oh, come on, this is just getting old. What?" "Never mind." Fortunately, this musing was far from what occurred in this case. Here, Aju sets the stage that this national teacher, he offered something. He offered the teaching and then waited to see what would happen. Ocean responded. He was attendant. He was responsible for attending, for answering. There was nowhere else for him to be. His responses were awake, alive, intimate. Calling and answering, teacher and student, both upholding the relationship. No pause, no hesitation. Most of our responses come from some kind of reactivity, automated, conditioned. We're asleep. Here we have presented an expression that's held within a wholeness and a unity. Attendant? Yes. Never mind. Attendant? Yes. Never mind. Attendant. Yes. Never mind. How must we train to bring forth this kind of intimacy? Intimacy that has no add-ons, no extra comments, no judgments, no exaggeration, no reference to a self. This is not easy. Calling and answering, it's not a game. This calling and answering goes to the very heart of responding from within the whole, responding from a place of lacking nothing. There's a sutra where the Buddha gives instruction on this. A man by the name of Bahia begs 3 times for instruction, and the Buddha finally agrees and says, "Then, Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will only be the seen. In reference to the heard, there will only be the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. When for you there will only be the seen in reference to the seen. Only the heard in reference to the heard. Only the sensed in reference to the sensed. Only the cognized in reference to the cognized. Then, Bahia, there is no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there's no you there, you are neither here nor yonder, nor in between the two. This, just this, is the end of suffering. This means that during Sesshin, what you see in front of you, you see in front of you. You don't try to penetrate experience to make contact with some kind of higher reality. You notice your judgments, your pain, your exaggerations, your longing. You open your eyes to wake up to the phenomenal world as it presents itself. All of this is human. All of this lacks nothing. All of this is your birthright. All of this is coming home to your authentic manifestation. A mind that is not separate from experience. A mind that is aware and present. This is a mind that is at peace. We offer our attention, and it returns intimacy. In this intimacy with what arises, there is no self-centered perspective. Sesshin offers an opportunity to mature our capacity for being intimately present to the world. We see who we are when we're awake. I always used to think about attention as being some kind of quality that we would strengthen, a quality that we would cultivate. I don't see it that way anymore. I think of attention as a relationship. Attention brings the world into being. We become partners in creation. So we practice noticing what's offered, what our karma brings, a sound, a thought, a sight, a feeling, and back to mu, or hu, or breath, or whatever your practice is. We let it flow through. And in this flow, there is no I. Sesshin is the time, over and over and over again. Attention, attention, attention. Yes, yes, yes. Dissolving the super glue, letting each moment have its life. So back to the koan. So Echu, the national teacher, says, I thought I had transgressed against you, but I say you have transgressed against me. I looked up transgress. It means to infringe or go beyond the bounds of a moral principle or standard of behavior. But this going beyond is not here meaning some simple violation of a social standard. The transgression was about standing alone in the vastness, calling forth the world. I wonder if Echu was concerned that ocean might not show up, that he could not answer from this vastness. The commentary says, the national teacher called three times and his tongue dropped to the ground. The attendant answered three times, sending out a corresponding glory. The national teacher, getting old and lonely, pushed the cow's head down to the grass. The attendant would have none of it. Even delicious food cannot attract a full stomach. Each moment, perfect and complete. That is the practice. And that is the fruit of practice. Each moment, perfect and complete. Sitting on the cushion, walking on the floor, doing your job, wishing for nothing, adding nothing, exaggerating nothing. We keep up this practice because there's nowhere else to be. There's nothing else to do. Over and over and over again, attention, attention, attention. Back to practice, back to practice, back to practice. Moving through the world with a full belly. There was no lack from the very beginning. You can't get what you already have. As the Buddha said, in heaven above and earth below, I am the only one calling and answering can only be manifested when the belly is full. The real transgression here, maybe the words, attendant, yes, already too much. Teacher and student calling and answering. But where is the teacher and where is the student? Too much thinking. The cries of the world are heard and the cries are responded to. And the verse. He must carry the holeless iron Hang, and his descendants too can have no peace or rest. Mumon uses the metaphor of a yoke with no hole. Echu, this great national teacher's liberation was not an end, not complete. He must continue this practice over and over and over again. No completion, no accomplishment, just attention, manifesting and demonstrating throughout his life, doing the work for the sake of others. And for Ocean, same thing. The blessed curse is passed on. He hears the call and softens and responds. Carrying on the tradition, taking it on to share the fruits of compassion with others. So he must carry the holeless iron kang, and his descendants too can have no peace or rest. If you want to support the gate and sustain the house, you must climb a mountain of swords with your bare feet. Most of us begin practice with a kind of exaggerated dreaminess, you know? Follow the instructions, get enlightened, feel the love, enjoy the ride. Mumon tells us there are sharp things, and it's not over till it's over. Coming to enlightenment, seeing the emptiness of all things, it's not an ending place, it's a beginning. Climbing a mountain of swords with your bare feet. I'm going to read you something that I read the other day that reminded me of the responsibility to bring the world into creation. It was a sharp thing. It may remind you, and this feels in a little harsher way, of the Heart Sutra. This is a song by Milarepa titled, The Understanding of Reality. In the realm of absolute truth, Buddha himself does not exist. There are no practices nor practitioners, no path, no realization, and no stages, no Buddha bodies and no wisdom. There is no nirvana. For these are merely names and thoughts. Matter and beings in the universe are non-existent from the start. They have never come to be. There is no truth, no innate born wisdom, no karma, and no effect therefrom. Samsara even has no name. Such is absolute truth. Emptiness. The stark truth of emptiness. But this emptiness is not an ending place. It's not a resting place. This is a sharp thing. Attention. There is participation required here. We have our practice. It's our friend and companion on this mountain of life moments that come freely before awakening and after awakening. Before and after, what difference does it make? We learn to navigate over sharp things by paying attention. This is what we come to Sesshin to practice. We come to Sesshin to say yes, yes, yes to whatever arises over and over and over again. Each moment is your moment, offering itself to you directly, nakedly, needing your attention, your awareness, your presence to bring it to life. We start with ourselves, and we notice our arrogance, our craziness, our wishing and hoping, our plans and dreams, our problems and our solutions. We make them visible with our attention. We use our practice to learn our humanness, to have compassion for this human condition, and to become intimate with what it means to be a whole human being. This intimate embrace is the only real gift you have to give the world. This world calls out to you, shows you your shining, beautiful, original face. It reveals all, but you have to show up. You have to show up for everything. You have to show up for sadness and pain and loneliness and joy and thoughts and opinions, for arrogance and sounds and smells. No lack, never any lack in this full, rich, whole human being. So please, this Sesshin, hear the calls of the world. Answer with compassion. Answer with attention. Answer with intimacy. The world awaits. And as Richard said, if you do this, the universe will never let you down. This Sesshin, for the sake of all beings, lavish your gift on everything you encounter. This is a trustworthy practice, and you are enough. We'll end there this morning.